Hello, Teach Lab listeners. We have a special treat for you today, our first Teach Lab crossover. Two of my dear friends and educators, Jesse Dukes and Chris Bagg, have launched a new podcast called Upper Middle Brow at uppermiddlebrow.com, where they discuss high craft works from popular culture. It's a book podcast where Jesse and Chris dig into successful, accessible books that are also beautifully written and help us understand what makes them tick. I got the chance to join them as a special guest for an episode about Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age. Stephenson is well known for rollicking tales like Snow Crash and Cryptonomicon, and The Diamond Age is one of his earlier works. The Upper Middle Brow guys brought me in because a key plot element in The Diamond Age is the Young Lady's Primer, a technological marvel, a digital book that uses pseudo-intelligence to provide customized instruction that accounts for the context and growth of the very special reader who has the book. Now, the Primer was originally built by one of the wealthiest citizens on Earth as a special gift for his granddaughter, but through various escapades and machinations, it finds its way into the hands of a street urchin named Nell. Jesse and Chris brought me on the show to help explain what parts of that technology might be real today or in the future, and what this extraordinary piece of sci-fi imagination about education reveals to us about our beliefs about teaching and learning. So the English teachers out there, I think, will love this podcast, as well as anyone who loves digging into great books. The language is a little bit saltier than usual on Teach Lab, but more PG-13 than anything that's rated R. Without further ado, we'll turn it over to Jesse and Chris.
Elizabeth and Fiona both had their hands on the wall now, as if it were home in a game of tag. But Nell had stopped and was turning her head from side to side, surveying the length of the wall as it clambered and tumbled over the increasingly rough shape of the land. After some time, she held out one hand, pointing at a section of the wall a short distance away, and began to move towards it.
Nell stands above the fray and thinks, Finkel McGraw said. To the other girls, the wall is a decorative feature, no? A pretty thing to run to and explore, but not to Nell. Nell knows what a wall is. It is a knowledge that went into her early, knowledge she doesn't have to think about. Nell is more interested in gates than walls. Secret, hidden gates are particularly interesting.
Had to kill one last group of tweens before we finished up.
Nice. You know,
they begged for their lives.
The tween, oh my God, really?
I wonder if this massive multiplayer semi-educational experience is actually good for your moral development, your moral education.
I mean, it certainly teaches you practicalities.
Right.
But what kind of practicalities?
Have enough like shark meat and pork and fish around so that if you get attacked by pirates, you won't get killed right away.
Is there ever a shortage of shark meat in the high seas?
Yeah, man. What do you think? Is shark meat all over the place?
Yeah, it literally grows on sharks.
Do you think shark meat just grows on coral reefs?
How do I sound?
You sound pretty good.
You sound good.
Yeah.
Hello, you know what? I didn't write an intro, so I'm going to, this is our first improvised intro. Yeah. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Upper Middle Brow. This is the bonus episode featuring an education technologist, somebody who filled out one of our pilot questionnaires, somebody who's being very honest and is open with his struggle with triglyceride levels, and a dear friend of both of us. In fact, the person who introduced us, I believe. We'd like to welcome to Upper Middle Brow, Justin Reich.
What a pleasure. Jesse Dukes, Chris Bagg.
It's great to see you. Can you give us your job title and job description? I would mess it up if I tried to do
it. Yeah, lay your bona fides on us, man.
I am the Mitsui Career Development Professor of Digital Media in the Comparative Studies and Writing Department in the School of Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I am also the author of Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education, recently re-released in paperback from Harvard University Press.
Wow. My God.
Can you talk a little bit also, because I, as I'm aware, for at least, I don't know, a decade or several years, one of your very specific research interests and focuses have been practical applications of technology in education. When did that start?
In 2003, I was trying to get a job teaching, and the department head who I was trying to get a job with said, "Can you teach world history?" And I said, "I have no idea, but I promise by September I'll be able to teach world history if you hire me." And then he said, "All right, maybe." In the classrooms we have for ninth grade world history, there's a cart of laptops in the back corner. There are these blue and orange clamshell MacBooks, this kind of really iconic form factor that some folks may remember. He said, "And you'll have to teach with them every day." And they connected to the internet. There was one for every student in the class. They had this software on them called First Class, which was a intranet service that did everything in 2003 that Google Suite for Education does on the cloud now. I told them, like, you could put a cart of bananas in the back corner of the classroom and I'll teach with them. I just really need this job. So I went and started, loved the teaching that I did there. We were early enough, as sort of ahead of most US teachers. So we started this consultancy with a colleague of mine called EdTech Teacher, which worked with schools and districts around the country, around the world. I went and got a doctorate in education technology things. When Harvard and MIT formed edX, I was the first full-time researcher that was hired by Harvard to sort of study massive open online courses, MOOCs, as they're known, through companies like edX and Coursera and stuff like that. I'm the steering committee chair for a conference called Learning at Scale. I spend a lot of time. I build some of these technologies. We built this digital clinical simulation tool called Teacher Moments that immerses teachers in vignettes of classroom life. And then a microphone icon pops up and you have to say what you would say to a kid or a student or a teacher. It's not quite a Reactive, but it's along those lines generally. So this is for better or worse what I do all the time. And I mean, a little bit of a weird thing about me is that I'm a technology developer, researcher, but I bring a pretty critical lens to it because I spent a bunch of time teaching. And it drives me nuts how much we can spend on this stuff. What really drives me nuts is people who make totally unfounded claims about what's possible with technology, and then schools and institutions invest a bunch in it and put too much effort into a direction which is not going to take them very far. So somewhat strangely, I do a lot with this, but I also, you know, really try to be an honest broker with schools, with universities, with policymakers, and be like, look, this is what we can accomplish. This is maybe what we can accomplish in the future. This is what we're not going to do in our lifetimes. Believe me, rather than these, VC funded knuckleheads who are trying to promise you the world, because I don't have a stake in it.
If instead of those clamshell laptops in the back corner of that classroom, there was a
crate of bananas,
what would you have taught and how would you have made it pertinent to world history?
I'm not 100% sure. I will say that on my very first week teaching, I found myself knuckle walking across the classroom. We did our world history class started
like a silverback gorilla might.
Like a silverback gorilla might knuckle walk across a classroom. It was not totally out of hand because we were teaching a unit on prehistory and there was some point that I was making, but I was like, man, I have been here for 3 days and I'm knuckle walking in front of these children. Like,
that was my experience as a teacher.
How low can you fall in such a short period of time? What do I have left?
You can teach world history through the lens of a commodity, right? You know, like if you track the banana and the development of banana. Yeah. You wouldn't necessarily use it as a teaching tool, like a game piece or something. Although I can imagine that too. You know, various games where people are throwing bananas at each other or things like that. But you could actually do a lot of teaching with the history of the banana.
Well, there's a zillion, cod, salt. There were all these kind of monosyllabic object titled books.
Corn.
One thing your listeners should look up is the Banana Lounge at MIT, which has recently gotten some press about it. But there is basically a lounge for which there's like a 10-person student committee. It's kind of in the middle of campus where they ensure that there are always bananas and as many as people want in the lounge. But it turns out that like 4,000 undergraduates want a lot of bananas. And so they basically have like a network of suppliers around the city of Boston who are like flying and training in bananas. bananas year round to be able to satiate the insatiable banana demands.
My God,
of probably, MIT students.
Probably all Cavendish bananas.
Yes.
If David Foster Wallace were still alive and still at MIT, that definitely would have shown up in one of his books in the last few years. Like this, like wild supply chain banana escapade intended to feed MIT undergraduates.
It's actually kind of very Stevensonian too, except for he wouldn't want to spend that much time in academia. But and you're also someone who's read the odd Stevenson book, right?
I had not read Diamond Age nor Zodiac, but just did Fall. Fall or Dodge in Hell. Had done Cryptonomicon, had done the whole Baroque cycle, or made my way through most of it. One thing that I'm desperate for your readers to find out, or your listeners or anyone to find out, is I believe that I got my copy of Snow Crash packaged in the 1990s in a video game that I bought. Like you go to the big box stores.
That happened, yes.
And what was the game?
It was a Snow Crash game.
What?
No, I'm almost positive it was not.
I don't think it is because
there's no Snow Crash game.
All right, there's no Snow Crash game.
Listener,
there's no Snow Crash movie.
If you can email us and tell us what the Snow Crash it is true that it came packaged in a game. I read that recently. If you can tell us what that game was, email JPD or BAGG at uppermiddlebrow.com, and we will mention you on air and send you some merch. And Justin
will send you a free
send you
copy
a banana.
Of Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education from Harvard University Press.
And a Cavendish banana from the Banana Lounge.
And a
at
dry
MIT.
Ice-packed Cavendish banana.
And a lobster from Boston Harbor.
All of these things.
Funny tie-in, which is you were one of the four people who listened to our pilots and filled out a survey of what you thought. We had some other listeners too, and we hope a few more. The second person was Catherine Nagasawa, my former colleague, who did a whole documentary about bananas and banana plantations in Central America, including a long history into the Cavendish banana, and basically why this sort of bland but pretty looking banana became the banana of choice everywhere, even though, Justin, as you and I can attest to, there are much more delicious but ugly looking bananas in other places like Tanzania.
They're just smaller. They're not even less attractive. Yeah, no, the Cavendish banana is the red.
Sugari.
It's the red delicious. And of course, Poa Kachizi Kama Ndizi, cool like a cold banana.
Cool like a cold banana in Swahili.
If you wanted to tell someone that they were, you know, that they were a cool operator,
Poa proper response to Mambo, which is like, what's up? And you could say Poa, and then if you had the really good Swahili, you'd say Poa Kachizi Kama Ndizi.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then people are like, oh, you've been here for more than a day, Muzungu. You've probably been here for a week. Justin, you just described yourself as a skeptic of the power of technology in education, at least the technological enthusiasm around certain new technologies that people are invested in. So I think one of the central questions of this book, could you actually educate a child the way that Nell is educated by the primer in the Diamond Age?
Could you educate Nell is unknown. Could you educate a child through books? For sure. We have centuries of autodidacts who are able to simply teach themselves enormous amounts of material. You don't even need Reactive. It's just, you know, plain old printed text. People are extraordinary at that, but not very many of them. You know, sort of sadly, one of the things that we found out quite a bit as online learning has spread widely is that the vast majority of people really need the social infrastructure of others to learn. They need the structure of classrooms to learn. There are very few people who are good at being autodidacts. And actually, most of the people who are good at being autodidacts are already educated, already affluent people who have the benefit of an apprenticeship of a formal education system. But they're, you know, the Ben Franklins of the world are out there.
Well, but also in this case, Nell's primer is not just a book. It's not a passive object. It's powered by a powerful artificial intelligence, which, what do they call a synthetic intelligence?
A pseudo intelligence.
Pseudo intelligence.
PI.
And it's watching Nell. It's observing. It's smart enough to realize when she's in trouble, when her domestic situation is getting stressful or violent. And it talks to her even when she's not engaging with the book. You know, one of the very first things that happens is a scary drunken boyfriend of her mother throws the primer at her, and it spreads itself out into the air to keep from impacting her, and then says, once upon a time, there was a princess. Well, at first mispronounces her name in a kind of unfortunate joke.
Ribald way.
In a ribald way. But then once Nell corrects it, says, once upon a time, there was a princess named Nell, and starts telling and draws her in to the process and is actually sort of guiding her along the education process, not unlike a teacher might, you know, giving her assignments, suggesting future reading. So I guess, like, if you know, could you imagine a book like that being an effective education tool for more than the most extraordinary autodidacts?
But probably not. Again, because it's really the social dimension of learning that compels most of us. Let me profess for a moment, if I might, as the professor, as a professor visiting. There are basically two ideas about how to teach. And Plutarch described them memorably when he said, learning is not the filling of a pail, but the kindling of a flame, to which centuries of education psychologists have said, no, it's the filling of a pail. A really great way to teach people is to just pour stuff into their heads. And in fact, we can like measure the optimal rate of pouring and how leaky the buckets are and all these kinds of things. So there are two ideas about teaching. They've been reasonably well refined in the 20th century. So the pail fillers have a set of theories called cognitive load theory, which explains something about how pail filling works. The flame kindlers, the apprenticeship people, have a set of ideas called situated learning, which explains a little bit about people, how people learn in communities of practice. But they're basically only two ideas. Weirdly, in the United States and other places, they sort of map onto politics a little bit. So we tend to associate sort of instructional things more with right-leaning politics. You know, phonics for reading instruction, pretty instructional, tends to be on that side. And the apprenticeship, kind of exploring yourself, John Dewey kind of stuff is more sort of lefty kinds of things, although education politics don't track as well as gun ownership or other kinds of things like that. So, you know, they're basically two ideas about how to teach. And of course, the unusual thing about a lady's first primer is that a book, you know, would ordinarily be considered a kind of pail filling sort of tool. But Stevenson is clearly a flame kindling kind of person, now one thing about having a viewpoint on education, which has these two poles, is that any educational strategy can always be attacked from the left and from the right. It can always be like insufficiently efficient in its pail filling, or it can be insufficiently engaging and democratic and nurturing in its flame kindling. So we could discuss all that as we go along. But that's a good kind of orientation for thinking about teaching in general.
If you were to identify the pedagogical philosophy behind this book, would you land more in the pail filling or flame kindling kind of side?
Perhaps we need a short reading.
Perfect.
One of the earliest passages. I'm on 96 in my edition. Princess Nell and Harve could not leave the dark castle, but from time to time, a raven would come to visit them. "What's a raven?" Nell said. The illustration was a colorful painting of the island seen from up in the sky. In the middle was a black dot. The picture zoomed in on the black dot, and it turned out to be a bird. Big letters appeared beneath. R-A-V-E-N, the book said. "Raven. Now say it with me. Raven." "Very good, Nell. You are a clever girl, and you have much talent with words. Can you spell raven?" Nell hesitated. She was still blushing from the praise. After a few seconds, the first of the letters began to blink. Nell prodded it. The letter grew until it had pushed all the other letters and pictures off the edges of the page. "R is for run," the book said. The picture kept on changing until it was a picture of Nell. Then something fuzzy and red appeared beneath her feet. "Nell runs on the red rug," the book said. And as it spoke, new words appear. "Why is she running?" "Because an angry alligator appeared," the book said, and on and on. So this is an approach to pedagogy. I guess I'd like to define it in two ways eventually, but the first one is just like this is a very whole language approach to teaching reading. It's a very experiential approach. There's a couple things the book never does. The book never says, this is the letter R. Another thing the book never does is, which one would do if you wanted to teach people how to read effectively for almost anyone, which is map the letters to sounds. You know, it talks about the angry alligator, but it doesn't explain why the A is long and angry and it's short and alligator. Mm. And you actually, you know, because English is a terrible, terrible language to young children because the sounds don't map to the letters. People really need direct instruction about that to almost everyone to make sense of reading. And I think another thing that's important about that scene is that the book stops at the moment of what is a raven, that it is sort of nominally driven by Nell's interest. But I will say that as much as that scene, you know, I've just made a little bit of the kind of like righty critique, like, come on, if you're going to teach reading, like you got to instruct people about reading. You can't just say a bunch of words at them and hope that they figure out what this is. But I was looking online for some critiques of the Ladies' Primer, and I found one by a guy named Andy Matuszek, who is part of this cabal of sort of education technology researchers. Brett Victor is another one. Brett Victor was the guy who built Al Gore's digital version of An Inconvenient Truth, you know, and Andy describes the Primer as kind of like fundamentally coercive. Like it's not actually an enabling learning environment because the book is constantly deciding what it is that Nell should learn, what it is that Nell should do, how it should be directing Nell and so forth. The contrast that Andy decides to make in a kind of like metaverse sort of learning experience is a young lady's Primer versus Minecraft. Where in Minecraft, there is this sort of fully immersive experience. But of course, the crucial part of Minecraft is you decide what the game is. You decide what it is that you want to build and create, do, where to go, where the Primer is sort of always coercing you. So to some extent, you could say, like as you could anywhere, that Stevenson has selected a particular kind of middle path between these two poles, which you might be able to critique from both sides.
Well, But in that case, the two, she does say, what's a raven? And it's like the book has a path. It wants Princess Nell or Nell to go down, but it's also constantly willing to stop and adapt, right? So, and when the book realizes, oh, Nell doesn't know what a raven is, and also Nell doesn't really know how to spell. Or recognize letters. It figures that out very quickly, and I actually find it very moving. There's that moment where Nell is still blushing from the praise, and one realizes as a reader, this might be one of the very first times that Nell has heard any praise in her life from anybody maybe other than her brother, too. And so it does seem to me that the book is doing a very good thing for Nell in that moment by telling her, look, you were very clever just now, and being patient with her, and that's something she was not getting from her parents or whatever passes for an education system in this particular dystopia that Nell is living in.
And then eventually we learn that the Ractor, the reactive actor Miranda, is the voice of the young lady's Primer and essentially falls in motherly love with Nell through doing all of this recording. And there is this sense, I mean, this I actually think is quite prescient of Neal Stephenson, again in 1990, where, you know, people are just starting to discover about the uncanny valley, the idea that when we generate, you know, when we generate 3D figures or CGI figures, we can't get them perfect enough. People always notice the difference between a CGI figure and when you go past cartoon and towards reality, you hit this uncanny valley where someone doesn't look quite right. And he realizes that with voice, you know, we won't quite be able to recognize the voice, that there will be something about a real human that is richer than the most technologically advanced AI voice. And I think that's basically right, and basically right for the future. And it's kind of neat that in 1990, Stevenson was on top of that.
And the two characters who got the most out of the Primer are Nell and Fiona, both of whom had a real human play acting the voice at them. And there are 250,000, half a million characters who did not have such an interaction and purely had I mean, I guess there in their case, it might have been an AI creating the voice. I'm not sure if there were they had the budget for the reactors. And so the mouse army, the orphaned Chinese girls who don't have that, do not learn nearly as much from the primer as Nell and Fiona.
And what they end up doing is like Nell kind of becomes their sort of teacher and mother figure. And there's like this certain point where you're like, is this a book about like a cult of personality? I mean, like at a certain point when you're kind of like, this does seem to be an argument for kind of traditional family values.
Very much so.
And then, yeah, I don't know. I do think it's interesting that we're talking about politics and about like how education doesn't map directly to politics. Cause I think this book does kind of swerve back and forth between different,
maybe not traditional family values, right? It's Miranda. It's not like one man, one woman, and their biological offspring. Yeah. But it is sort of like you need a parental figure in your life.
And you were kind of, Justin, you were already talking about that, that like the thing that drives education is that social interaction. Does that feel correct in this book? Like where it's like, yeah, the social interaction with Miranda is the thing that works for Nell.
Yeah, you know, if you wanted to credit the young lady's pervert, it also has what psychologists would call parasocial relationships, relationships that we create with figures. So she has a relationship with Purple and with Dojo and sort of with other characters in the story with whom she bonds and forms relationships. And, you know, there's all kinds of powerful ways, as you all sort of reveal in your own discussions, that we fall in love or, you know, you told us how vigorously you hated Tom Ripley, you know, that same kind of loathing can be reversed, and we can find people who's you know, Robert Pirsig's characters in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance becomes a father figure and a mentor to a generation of people in a way that's not, you know, just like, you know, words spouting wisdom, you know, not in a way that Confucius is not when you read him, but maybe Pirsig is for some people.
Right, right. And probably a much better father figure than the actual Robert Pirsig, from what I know about the actual Robert Pirsig.
We have another reading, then like a question to kind of go off of that. But this comes from the section of the book when Lord Chung Sik Finkel McGraw, I can't resist saying his entire surname because I think it is a joke that Stevenson enjoys very much so. But he and John Percival Hackworth's estranged wife at this point, I don't think divorced wife, are having tea or some social engagement. And Finkel McGraw's granddaughter, Elizabeth Finkel McGraw, Fiona Hackworth, Gwendolyn Hackworth's and John Percival Hackworth's daughter, and Nell are all playing together.
They all have a copy of the primer.
Yes, they've all been raised with the primer. And Finkel McGraw is sort of half quizzing Gwen Hackworth about what's going to happen. He's really using her as sort of a straw woman that he can bounce his ideas off of. But we brought this up because we wanted to pose this section and then have you chat a little bit about what this book is saying about the differences between nature and nurture.
Very well. I will expose myself to the risk of humiliation by predicting that Elizabeth reaches the wall first, that Nell finds the secret way through, but that your daughter is the first one to venture through it. I'm sure you could never be humiliated in my presence, Your Grace, Mrs. Hackworth said. It was something she had to say, and he did not really hear it. They turned back to the windows. When the girls had reached to within a stone's throw of the wall, they began to move toward it more purposefully. Elizabeth broke free from the group, ran forward, and was the first to touch the cool stones, followed a few paces later by Fiona. Nell was far behind, not having altered her steady stride. Elizabeth is a duke's granddaughter, accustomed to having her way and has no natural reticence. She surges to the fore and claims the goal as her birthright, Finkel McGraw explained. But she has not really thought about what she's doing. Elizabeth and Fiona both had their hands on the wall now, as if it were home in a game of tag. But Nell had stopped and was turning her head from side to side, surveying the length of the wall as it clambered and tumbled over the increasingly rough shape of the land. After some time, she held out one hand, pointing at a section of the wall a short distance away, and began to move towards it. Nell stands above the fray and thinks, Finkel McGraw said. To the other girls, the wall is a decorative feature, no? A pretty thing to run to and explore, but not to Nell. Nell knows what a wall is. It is a knowledge that went into her early, knowledge she doesn't have to think about. Nell is more interested in gates than in walls. Secret, hidden gates are particularly interesting. Fiona and Elizabeth moved uncertainly, trailing their tiny pink hands across the damp stone, unable to see where Nell was leading them. Nell strode across the grass until she had reached a small declivity. She almost disappeared into it as she clambered down towards the foundation of the wall.
An opening for drainage, Finkel McGraw explained. Please do not be concerned. I happened to ride that way this morning. The current is only ankle deep, and the diameter of the culvert just right for 8-year-old girls. The passage is several meters long, more promising than threatening, I should hope.
Fiona and Elizabeth moved cautiously, startled by Nell's discovery. All three of the girls disappeared into the cleft. A few moments later, a blaze of fiery red could be descried bouncing rapidly across the moor beyond the wall. Fiona clambered up a small outcropping of rocks that marked the beginning of the moor and beckoned excitedly to her companions.
Any thoughts before we ask you a question about that?
One of the things that the reading makes me think about that maybe... Two things maybe that Neal Stephenson and I probably have in common in thinking about educational outcomes is that one, the paths that any of us take are enormously complex. There's something in there which maybe is nature. But I think the other thing he's talking about is kind of the learning experiences that we have coming into school and then what school can do. Clearly, in particular, Nell's, you know, caution, reticence, heightened paranoia is, you know, probably not something she's born with. It's a function of living in poverty and in terror for a good chunk of her life. I think the other thing that we get throughout, and it's a source of anxiety for Lord Chingsuk Finkel McGraw, is the kind of probabilistic nature of learning. You know, I think Neal Stephenson, in my view, to his credit, thinks of the primer not deterministically, not as if you give the kid the primer, you will get this outcome. But if you give enough kids the primer, a bunch of them will have this kind of outcome, and some of them will have an even more desirable outcome. I mean, there's a sort of sense that, like, one of the core functions of the primer is to generate in this Victorian society a set of young people subversive and brilliant enough to keep the society moving forward. Will it be Elizabeth? Will it be Nell? Will it be Fiona? We don't really know, but probably if we give enough kids this thing, at least one of them will. And I think, the book reveals so many of the anxieties that we have about education. Education is meant to get our individual students ahead. Education is meant to shake up society, is to make sure it doesn't get too stuck. Education is meant to alleviate poverty, that technology-mediated education, this is something, very much alive in our time today, is that we are never, just like we're never going to have enough teachers for these 250,000 kids on boats, there are kids on boats all over the world. We're never going to have enough teachers for the children who are living in flooded lands in Pakistan. We're never going to have enough teachers for people in all kinds of disadvantaged places in the world. What if technology could step in? What if the primer could exist to fill in those moments? And it maybe is not surprising that, like, their version of the primer is like a little bit inferior to make sure they can't quite catch up to the elites who get the really good primer. That seems like, a pretty baked in feature of our education system too.
Curious, what would you say to somebody if, you did have a person of means, somebody who was interested in developing a technology, maybe they had even read this book and they were inspired and they wanted to.
I mean, we'll name names here, although I'm not 100% sure I remember who this guy is, but I'm pretty sure it was the guy who founded Android. When you're at MIT, rich, accomplished people just get sort of brought through periodically. Mm-hmm. And this guy comes to me and is like, I did Android and I did this other company. And so now I'm making a ladies' primer. He had the unfortunate timing to come to me after I had spent 5 or 6 years working with Massive Open Online Courses. So kind of an amazing thing about Massive Open Online Courses is that we collected reams and reams of data, transcribed to the millisecond about everything that literally millions of people did in these learning environments, a huge trove of data. And we learned almost nothing about teaching and learning from it. It was almost a total research flop. And I was like, my guy, who cares if you're capturing, the written, like, we got keystrokes from everyone. Like, fine, you're going to get pen strokes. But what's the difference? Like, this is a failure of the current state of AI and education. And it is a bit of a failure of Neal Stephenson's imagination. So this is a book that part of what makes it interesting is you kind of trace technologies throughout systems and their whole consequences. You start with a Matter compiler and it's like, where you're going to have a feed, and the feed is going to have these feedstocks from different places. And these are the consequences of society. If you have an artificial intelligence, is generated by training it on data created by humans. We have no shortage of students. We do not need to train artificially intelligent agents on student data. What we need are teachers. If you wanted to have some kind of artificially intelligent teaching, you would have to have reams and reams of data about what it is that teachers do in any given moment. When you encounter a girl who has never read before and has some kind of question about a character in a book, do you praise her a lot? Do you praise her a little? Do you start with letters? Do you start with pictures? Do you start with word sounds? You would want to have just millions and millions of interactions where you know what a student state was, what the teacher action was, and then another enormously difficult thing, what were the short-term and long-term consequences of that particular action? Like, if you were to actually play this out, it's not so much that you need a whole army of raptors generating this thing. You actually need to have surveilled millions of teachers committing zillions of teaching acts, capturing, you need like a whole colony of teachers who are under constant surveillance so you can develop these probabilistic models of how any move could work. Now, a crazy thing is that my colleagues in the field of AI and education have not bothered to even start doing this in many ways. That like the whole field of AI education is like, you know what we've got a ton of is student data. Like, why don't we just study the heck out of student data? And it really is like, the sort of drunk at the lamppost being like, where did you drop your keys? Oh, over there. Well, why are you looking here? It's where the light is.
So should somebody do that? Should somebody start getting AIs to start studying what teachers do all the time to try? I mean, could you imagine, say, if you had enough time, call it 100 years, could you make an artificial intelligent educator that's as good at it as the primer is, as they say in New Victoria?
Probably not, but we probably could make a lot more progress on certain discrete kinds of things. We could create intelligent tutors that can see the kinds of common mistakes that you make in math class and know something about you. I mean, we've made some progress along these lines. I mean, I have a colleague who runs a system out of Worcester Polytechnic Institute called Assessments, where basically you put in your homework answers the night before and it sort of pipes those answers on 1 to 17 odd and lesson 42 to your teacher, who knows that, everybody got 15 wrong, so they can teach that. He started like trying to build a kind of, you know how Gmail has this autocomplete for things that you're typing? He's tried to build autocompletes for common wrong answers. So you have a bunch of teachers who see wrong answers and they type out what they think good responses would be. And then as you, an educator, later, there's a human in the loop. You can sort of see what those answers are, choose from one of them or modify them or make your own. We can figure out which of them are good hints or which of them are bad hints. All probabilistically, not deterministically. We never really know for any given person what will work. We're more likely to know that of the 250,000 children who are growing up in boats, if we give them this hint, 70% of them will react to it positively, 25% neutrally, and 5% negatively, and things like that. The bummer about education technology is that it helps, but like a little bit. It can take an awful lot of work to, build something that we're like, oh man, like, we're now a tenth of a standard deviation better at teaching kids Algebra 1 after 30 years of research or something like that.
Has anybody developed any, first of all, any studies that check and see if teachers begin behaving differently when they know that there's a possibility that they might be being watched?
Sure. I mean, we know, you know, I mean, very basic versions of that is like the lessons that teachers do when they're being observed are formally observed by principals are like complete farces oftentimes. You know, there's just like made up ritual activity of you know, because in because we've done terrible things.
I warrant also probably journalists and politicians.
Yeah, all these people come in. But when the principals come in, they like have a rubric and the rubric says you have to do certain things. Actually, in lots of forms of good pedagogy don't align well with the rubric. You know, it's like sometimes you hear all the time teachers will come up with this really cool lesson where like students are interacting with each other in all kinds of interesting ways, having powerful learning experiences. And a principal at the end of the lesson would be like, hey, can I come back someday that you're actually teaching? You know, because the rubric is asking like, you know, did they ask the right questions? Did they lecture clearly? Did they intervene in these ways? Yeah, you know, probably the first place we'll get real traction with like truly artificially intelligent teaching models will be in tutorial kinds of circumstances. It'll be like one teacher, one student. I mean, this is one of the defining questions of our age is, are there morally acceptable, humane, ethical ways to surveil people to train models? And even the most basic of examples leave you with deep, frustrating questions. I mean, you know, some of the very first models we trained were people label their photos online. And the way, you know, so you all as a hobby have posted all these pictures online and you've said, this is a grape and this is a raven and this is an ape and this is a person. And then we send machines over. The machines take those pictures. They break those pictures into a bunch of numbers. Like they don't recognize what the pictures are. They make just vectors of lines and colors and things like that. And they say, this particular combination of numbers is an ape. And then there's a bunch of racist people who have labeled apes as black people. And so the artificially intelligent agents start labeling pictures of black people as apes. And here's this sort of racist labeling that's happened. So even in what we think are the most like basic, benign, sort of morally neutral kinds of activities that we're like, shit, we're just, you know, we train all these AI things with us and they turn out to be racist.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Garbage in, garbage out. But, you know, but then a lot of people are like, hey, it's pretty cool if you can label pictures. Like, that's pretty sweet. There's all kinds of good applications that we can use that for. I mean, we can also use it, you know, it plays a crucial role in imprisoning and the cultural genocide against the Uyghurs in China. You know, how we generate these tools, what we do with these tools are compelling questions to ask. So, you know, many of which are kind of evoked throughout a diamond age. You know, what is the T of any given technology? Like, how does it fit with our society? Some of those kinds of things.
Where do you think this book lands on the efficacy of the education that it puts forth? Like, do you think that the diamond age is like, yes, Primer, good idea? Or do you think it is more of a cautionary tale?
You know, I appreciate his sense of the limits of his efficacy. But I think those 250,000 children on boats are a feature of our society. Mm. You know, there are millions of people who are hungry in, you know, certainly for primary education, but particularly for higher education. Like if you wanted everyone in China to have access to higher education at the demand that they want it, you have to do something like build a University of Michigan every day. Every day of the year, you have to generate another 40,000 person university to begin to map on to the demand that exists. Like, we're not going to build a university. And so what is the role that technology is going to play? And I think, you know, Stevenson also recognizes that it's sort of an interesting feature of all this technology is that a lot of it we use because we enjoy it. I mean, I'm sure almost all of your listeners have as one of their hobbies interaction with online resources, with communities, with technologies and tutorials. People love logging on to MOOCs or to Khan Academy or to tutors, things that are not that far, you know, in some respects from the basic feature of like, we're going to tell you this little story or this series of stories and give you some quizzes along the way. And
for me, it's like some guy being like, let me show you how PEX plumbing works. I went to plumb my bathroom today and I'm going to go ahead and set up this camera here and you can watch me do it.
I mean, there's the scene where where Nell is trying to make a fire. And the, you know, because the book doesn't come with a headset, it basically has a system that people have tried to generate with the Xbox Kinect. So the Xbox Kinect is this sort of set of cameras
that points
out of the screen. You know, and there's this like scene where in theory, Nell is like trying to light a fire by waving her hands around, and the Nell and the Princess Nell then does these actions to light a fire. It's like, oh, give me a break. There, you know, this is just an incredibly tactile activity for which you would never be able to light a fire without your hands physically on these materials. That was sort of one of the moments where the spell is broken.
I can't tell, Justin, if you feel like you talked about the 250,000 children on boats and then our own world's version of that. You know, the children of the world who don't have access to good education, don't have access to good schools, maybe don't even have, you know, parents who have the time and energy or inclination to educate them. I'm unclear whether you think there is some sort of useful Mookie or massive multiplayer online game or tablet or something that could be useful to kids in that situation.
Yeah, they're certainly not as kind of universal and flexible as the primer is. But during the pandemic, we shut down, you know, maybe 1.4, 1.8 billion learners were sent home. No one in the world knew, because it's not really possible, knew how to teach young children mathematics over a Zoom connection. But one of the things that we did have were these sort of gamified math apps, things like Dreambox, like STMath, other kinds of things like that, which actually have historically not performed particularly well in randomized controlled trials when you compare them as business as usual math instruction. But we didn't have business as usual math instruction during the pandemic. Right. We had chaos. And we doled out, you know, logins to Dreambox to hundreds of thousands, I don't know, maybe millions of kids. And they probably learned some math. They probably learned more math than if we had done nothing with them. They probably didn't learn as much math as if we had like hired a personal tutor for every kid to make their way in their home and teach them math. But like, you know, we did have hundreds of thousands of kids on boats who didn't have access to the learning environments that we expected them to, whose parents were out working. And we had, you know, we didn't have the whole Ladies Primer, but we had like, you know, pages 147 through 159, which happened to be about math for young kids. And, you know, we put them in a story. We had them play games. The games motivated them. They taught them stuff. I mean, there's this great line from Dojo the Mouse who says something like, you know, but what is a game but a drill dressed up in costume or something like that? And, you know, so we have little bits of the Ladies Primer, and we'll never have the whole thing for the reasons that I described about the sort of probabilistic nature of teaching. Can I take us in a left turn to something that we haven't discussed yet? Because another part of the educational philosophy and approach here is all of this stuff about myth and mythos, the idea that the real that the thing that they could, that John Percival Hackworth can encode in the Ladies Primer, in it, like one part of it is pseudo-intelligence, but the other part of it is the world's mythology. And the world's mythology has these sort of deep human truths about learning. Did you guys read the book or were familiar with the phenomenon of Iron John by Robert Bly? So Iron John, Robert Bly is this guy who apparently, I was just looking back at this, spent 60 weeks in 1990 in the New York Times bestseller list. The pedagogy, Robert Bly is a practitioner of the men's mythopoetic movement. The idea that basically like manhood is kind of broken we're not fixing it by turning men into softies, but we don't want them to go back to being the jerks they were before. We need a new direction for manhood. And where we're going to find that is in our ancient myths. And so the pedagogy of Iron John is that Robert Bly tries to make you feel like he's reading you the story of Iron John, and then periodically pauses along the way to kind of answer reader questions and reinterpret. So, you know, so it tells a story like, you know, in a kingdom, there's a dangerous wood. There's a huntsman who goes into the dangerous wood and with his dog and finds a pond. In the pond, an arm reaches up and grabs the dog and drowns it. The huntsman goes back and gets a bucket brigade and empties out the pond. And at the bottom is a wild man who calls himself Iron John. And then he sort of poses rhetorically, what is the pond? You know, very similar. What is the raven? What is kindling? What is the pond? And in that moment, Robert Bly then steps out of the role of the reader and says, here's what we know about what the pond is meant to represent. Here are other stories who have versions of this pond. And if you can decode what the pond means, then that will give you this sort of secret insight from these stories which have been refined by men and women over millennia to reveal deep human truths. So, you know, that is another kind of pedagogical through line of the Lady's Primer, which is basically like, you know, if Robert Bly's Iron John is a kind of story for young lost men, then a Lady's Primer is doing the same kinds of things for young girls growing up.
Do you find the sort of mythopoetic approach, like, do you think it sounded like you were kind of enthusiastic about it and enthusiastic about its place in the primer? Is that something, does that an educational approach that you are intrigued by?
You know,
I thought you were saying that it was a bunch of 1990s trendy hogwash that had infected Stevenson, similar to Joseph Campbell, right? But sort of a new iteration of the Joseph Campbell phenomenon.
So, I mean, it was certainly compelling to me at the time. I mean, I definitely remember thinking in the 1990s, like, yeah, we need like the manhood options that are up for me are not that great. And it would be cool to find some better ones. It was certainly one of the core stories of Iron John is that men need men other than their fathers to bring them into adulthood. And, you know, the three of us in part connected at this boys' camp on the coast of Maine, Chewonky. And so I am deeply sympathetic to the idea that can be a pretty good idea to have young men brought up by other somewhat older men who are not their fathers and not their family members and things like that. I think, you know, as an educational scientist, the more you start thinking about like really complex long-term life outcomes, just the worse our science is. Like, how do you teach someone as a young person to be moral in adulthood? We don't really have any idea. We're much better at like, what do you teach them in math in first grade that has them do math in second grade? But I will say in recent years, a thing that would sort of very rapidly turn you off is that the most compelling practitioner in the world today of this kind of mythopoetic, deep exegesis of mythology approach is, of course, Jordan Peterson. His story in many ways is exactly the same as Robert Bly's. Particularly like if you listen to Jordan Peterson, you know, on sort of right wing radio stories and things like that, he's just going off about the globalists or whatever. But if you read the kinds of things that he does when he's in an auditorium full of young men, it's much more like you need to clean up your room and you need to like pull yourself up by your bootstraps and eat cereal in the morning. And the reason you need to do that is because we have all these mythological stories. He's doing the same kind of Jungian analysis that Robert Bly is doing, except that Robert Bly was a kind of center lefty and Jordan Peterson is like center right with this group of people, you know, before heading into lunacy and other dimensions. So anyway, When Jordan Peterson is the sort of canonical person of the age practicing this particular pedagogical approach, sort of makes you think, oh, maybe this is not such a good idea.
Well, yeah, and I've been thinking about whether we even really need to teach young males about manhood per se, and whether there is simply personhood that people need to learn about and discover. And if you wish to create a version of masculinity or manhood that suits you, fine, do it. And, you know, if you want to read some mythology about it, or if like me, you like, you know, cowboy boots and belt buckles and don't mind gun ownership and that's your version of manhood, great. But I don't know that we need to be involving pedagogy and formal education and sort of helping people figure out their gender identity or how they express them.
Stevenson at least is aligned with you in that. I mean, this is certainly a radical vision of what you would teach a young woman in society. I mean, especially for 1995. I mean, I always have to sort of pull myself back into my young adulthood and be, you know, just how casually transphobic we were, how casually right. racist we were. Right. And I mean, not that we're not transphobic and not racist now and all that kind of stuff, but you know, this was, I think, a far more like, this is not raising Nell as a tomboy. This is like, you know, teaching a little girl to stab people in the eye with a screwdriver and to lead armies and to fight dinosaurs and to be, you know, and to be computer programmers, you know, again, at a time when I'm sure Stevenson knows, you know, the number of computer programmers, you know, women earning PhDs had collapsed in the 70s and 80s. I mean, women who were at the very forefront of computing when it was developed in the 50s and 60s, as, you know, Hidden Figures and other kinds of films and media show, just disappear for reasons that we still can't totally get our heads wrapped around, except that it became, you know, probably the simplest explanation is it became clear that computing was a pathway to power, and then men monopolized it. You know, there, I mean, I think there's something quite subversive about gender roles in a young lady's primer. And of course, wrapped up in all this kind of Victorianism, which makes it even funnier.
Yeah,
totally. I think that sets up what I think will be our, at least Bag and I's final reading. Did I just lose the, you know what? I just lost the page.
What do you got, Bag?
I want to dig more at the.
I found it.
You found it. I want to sidebar at some point about the Robert Bly stuff, because I've been through the Mankind Project. Like, I went through that and I'd done that program and still am like an attending member. Interested to chat more at some point.
Robert Bly also is a major American poet, right?
He's an okay poet. He's like,
when you read his stuff,
poet shade.
How about this though? I mean, a thing that sort of shook me a little bit, I went back and read some Iron John. You know, the first long quote in there is from Wordsworth. The first long piece of poem cited by Finkel McGraw when he meets John Percival Haxville is Wordsworth. I mean, there's some, I don't know if it's like
I don't one, think there's I don't think there. There's any way Stevenson had not read Iron John as well as Joseph Campbell. I especially given what we know about Stevenson's reading habits.
You can't discuss Iron John without mentioning that Utah Phillips, a later poet and folk musician, memorably described folks who are followers of Robert Bly as going around and dragging their scrotums through the underbrush, which I think is just a fabulous summary.
It's a wonderful, poetic wonderful image, which would be happening if you were knuckle walking too, like a gorilla. Walking,
yeah, no, that's exactly what you're meant to. That's how the scrotum gets down to the low materials, exactly. Through that kind of naked knuckle walking.
All right, so this is a passage. It's coming from a time where Nell is in her teens and along with the other two girls has been attending this neo-Victorian school in Source Victoria through the interventions of a certain Miss Matheson, who is a nonagenarian or merely an octogenarian.
She's described as an octogenarian. But I'm not sure.
Former skateboard delivery thrasher, similar to YT. The one sort of obvious nod that Stevenson gives us that this is in fact supposed to be in the same universe as Snow Crash. And Nell and also Fiona and Elizabeth have been having kind of a rough time in the school because they're used to the primer, and the school has a lot of kind of authoritarian elements to it, a lot of strict discipline. In fact, there's a teacher named Miss Stricken, who Nell has just had a run-in with. And Miss Matheson is sort of taking a soft approach with them and being very gentle with them, but also sort of explaining why the school is taking this strict, rigid disciplinarian approach. And so Miss Matheson says to them, I think it's Nell and Fiona, I don't think Elizabeth is there, "It's a wonderful thing to be clever, and you should never think otherwise, and you should never stop being that way. But what you learn as you get older is that there are a few billion other people in the world all trying to be clever at the same time. And whatever you do in your life will certainly be lost, swallowed up in the ocean, unless you're doing it along with like-minded people who will remember your contributions and carry them forward. That is why the world is divided into tribes. There are many lesser files and three great ones. What are the great ones? New Atlantis, Nell began. Nippon, said Fiona. Han, they concluded together. That is correct, Miss Matheson said. We traditionally include Han in the list because of its immense size and age, even though it has lately been crippled by intestine discord. Can that be right? Crippled
it's
by...
It's a great line. Intestine to discord.
I guess it is intestine discord. I hadn't caught that. Crippled by intestine discord. And some would include Hindustan, while others would view it as a riotously diverse collection of micro-tribes sintered together according to some formula we don't get. Another great sentence. Now, there was a time when we believed what a human mind could accomplish was determined by genetic factors. Piffle, of course, but it looked convincing for many years because distinctions between tribes were so evident. Now we understand it's all cultural. That, after all, is what a culture is, a group of people who share in common certain acquired traits. Information technology has freed culture from the necessity of owning particular bits of land in order to propagate. Now we can live anywhere. The Common Economic Protocol specifies how this is to be arranged. Some cultures are prosperous, some are not. Some value rational discourse and the scientific method, some do not. Some encourage freedom of expression, and some discourage it. The only thing they have in common is that if they do not propagate, they will be swallowed up by the others. All they have built up will be torn down, and all they have accomplished will be forgotten. All they have learned and written will be scattered to the wind. In the old days, it was easy to remember this because of the constant necessity of border defense. Nowadays, it is all too easily forgotten. New Atlantis, like many tribes, propagates itself largely through education. That is the raison d'etre of this academy. Here, you develop your bodies through exercise and dance, and your minds by doing projects. And then you go to Miss Stricken's class. And here she goes on and has a little colloquy about the purpose of Miss Stricken's class, which is basically to teach you that the world is a tough-ass place. But I'm curious, before we move on to Miss Stricken, or without moving on to Miss Stricken, Justin, what do you think of Miss Matheson's philosophy about the purpose of education? That the purpose of education, at least in Miss Matheson's mind, is to perpetuate the knowledge of this particular tribe, of this particular culture. It is essentially to induct somebody and to raise somebody in their culture and make them a functioning member for the sake of the preservation of that culture.
I mean, it is assuredly true that is one of the purposes. So my canonical answer to these things, there's no single purpose to education. There are a series of competing purposes of education. And one of the things that makes schools inherently political entities is that we disagree about the purposes of education. So for evangelicals in the South, the purpose of schools is to teach kids reading and writing, and the preservation of their culture is, evangelical culture is performed in church. And it is a threat to that culture to have there be other secular institutions that are intervening in certain kinds of ways. That's not universal. I don't want to paint every evangelical that way, but that's kind of a common theme. There are other folks who would say that the purpose is preservation of some of our culture, but also unearthing other parts of our culture. I mean, there's all kinds of folks who want to see schools as agents of social change, is that we need to be able to teach kids the weaknesses of our culture and how to attack them, or we need to somewhat more sort of politically neutrally, we need to give young people the tools to analyze their culture, their government, and make changes. And of course, these purposes are inherently contradictory. They are literally at cross purposes with one another. You know, we want to teach people to be good citizens, and we want to teach people to critique and resist their government. Like, sometimes those align and sometimes they don't. The magic of public schools is that in most towns, for most of their history, they turn these incredibly political questions into technical problems. They smooth over the politics of them so people from lots of different backgrounds and beliefs and life circumstances can send their kids to school, have them all cheer on the football team at the same time, and have some quibbles, but basically agree like, yeah, this place is sort of doing most of what I'm hoping to do. And in fact, if you want to destroy public schools,
the way to do that, one way to do that is to refuse to let these institutions and the experts in them do their technical work and to constantly be raising these political questions over and over back into the faces of teachers and policymakers and things like that, which is part of what, you know, like whatever that group is, Moms for School Liberty and stuff like that. I mean, part of the current right-wing attack on schools is to make it impossible for them to sort out these questions in a sort of in a technical, expert-driven fashion, you know, which sometimes, of course, is a good idea. You know, like, I mean, in the 1960s, there was a technical consensus that we should, you know, teach Black people that they were inferior. And then there are a whole bunch of families who made that a political question and resisted it. And then we renegotiated it. And then we came, you know, again, to like this miraculous technical solution. I mean, if you survey the vast majority of Americans, what they feel about how schools are doing teaching about race, most of them are happy with it. A chunk of them think they don't teach enough about race, and a chunk of them think they teach too much, which, as any of you have ever taught, know is the best that you can do. There's, you know, you just want your critics to be kind of split on opposite sides. You want the majority to be happy, critics to be a little bit on both sides, and that's the best success can look like.
At least in a democracy.
Yes.
we think that you have some trivia for us.
Yes, but we will move away from education. It will serve as an enjoyable corrective. In approximately what year is the first known server level world boss in a massively multiplayer game? I can multiple choice it for you if you want.
But. So wait, what year does is there the first appearance of a boss figure in a massive multiplayer?
And I'm not someone who plays massive multiplayer games, so this would be a boss that anybody playing the game could take on. Does everybody playing the game eventually take that boss on, or will only one person or party ever defeat it?
There's probably a number of different ways to do it, but it is fairly common practice for these world bosses to spawn, for everyone to have a shot at it, for some mechanism to kill the boss, and then to have the boss sort of respawn periodically.
I see. So some party might be the first, and that would be public to kill this particular word boss.
Yep.
Do you want to take a guess before we get the multiple choice? I think I'm going to need the multiple choice.
Yeah, there might be a multiple choice. I wonder if there. So there's kind of an obvious. Like, I think Justin has baited the hook, like, to like pull us in the direction of World of Warcraft. And I am racking my brain for like
was there some other was there game like a like
Zork
that
you could like log on to a server and play in the early 90s?
Could there have been a text-based game at some point? I mean, I remember in the early 90s, friends of mine playing Duke Nukem on by a serial connection. Then I think some people were using the internet to sort of treat that way, and I think Doom certainly could be played sort of like as a
eventually you could play against each other, but not a massive, but it wasn't massive,
right?
It was local.
But could it be something like a text-based game, like a maze game, like Adventure?
Was there a Zork that you could play on, that you could log on to like an FTP server, and
you had a command line or something like that, and you know there was some kind of, you know, Unix type command line that you could see who else was playing and what their stats were. I'm guessing it was something like that.
I think we need the multiple choice because we're looking for a year. So you might just completely be like, no, it's all post 2000.
Well, how about 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, 2000s?
I'm going to say 1980s. I'm going to make a bold. I'm going to say that it was in the era of widespread PCs, but prior to a sort of GUI World Wide Web.
God, I wonder if since we've got decades going back as far as the 60s, I wonder if this is like a war games kind of thing.
I could see a 70s sort of war game as well, or like something that the Rand Corporation developed for NORAD or something like that.
Isn't
that sort of the premise of the War Games movie?
Yeah.
Like it's a game like that and he triggers a nuclear incident.
Yeah. Which then Orson Scott Card ran it was like, let's just put it in space. Oh, spoilers, everyone. Sorry. Jeez. I didn't say the name of the book. but, Okay, what were our choices? 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, or aughts?
Yep.
Okay.
That's not the spoiler of Ender's Game. The spoiler of Ender's Game is something else.
I totally thought you were about to do it.
Don't tempt me.
Yeah, I might if you don't treat me nicely the rest of the evening.
If Jesse's going to the 80s, I'm gonna lean into the World of Warcraft and go with aughts.
Over the 1976 Christmas break, Chuck Miller and another friend who'd become hooked on Play-Doh, Jim Batten, modified Empire's Code to add a surprise element to the game. So in the 1960s, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, they had developed, and this is all documented in a lovely book by Brian Deere called The Friendly Orange Glow, had developed what was essentially the first, you know, one of the first widely used network computing systems called the Friendly Orange Glow, if people can remember those sort of orange two-color CRT monitors.
Yeah.
And somebody had programmed up this game called Empire, which I sort of had access to in the early 80s. A clone of it was called Apple Trek, although it was a one-player version of it. But basically, it's a multiplayer game. Nobody has a computer. There's a server somewhere, and people only have terminals that log into the server. And you play as Klingons and Romulans and the Federation and their planets and ships and things like that. People had been playing this game voraciously for years. And in 1976, a giant carrot-shaped thing starts flying across the screens of people's Empire game, and people recognize, and it starts killing everything. Starts killing all your ships, start killing all your planets, and people realize it as having enough nods to a pretty popular Star Trek episode called The Doomsday Machine. And somebody realizes, you know, the way that you kill the Doomsday Machine, Captain Kirk like hops in a pod and flies it towards the Doomsday Machine, hits self-destruct and is beamed out right at the last moment. And so people start taking their ships and flinging it towards this giant screen carrot, hitting the self-destruct button. You know, like everybody in the server ends up lining up in front of this thing, sort of throwing their ship at it. And there's some like very small pixel window that you need to hit there. You know, and I mean, the thing about the Play-Doh system is everything you know from the internet was invented in the 60s and 70s. It had real-time messaging. It has news boards. It had email services. It had
pornography.
So again, like early images, some of the early images are kind of rendered as pinups and things like that.
I remember seeing some like ASCII pinups.
Yeah.
Some of those, you know, but these are people who like in the 1960s, one of their triumphs was that you could push a button on a keyboard and a letter would render in front of you in near real time.
Yeah.
Like that the most basic of kind of personal computing functions.
Which is amazing. Yeah. I mean, that is still unbelievable. Unbelievable. We were talking about that tonight with Cryptonomicon.
Right. Cryptonomicon is the era prior to that, where you have all these different people using punch code machines and like cash registers and tape and vacuum tubes to be essentially memory storage devices that take up acres and acres of land that store less memory, you know, than this recorder that it, whoops.
This recorder that I
just turned off and turned back on.
But I will say for the gaming nerds out there, and again, you know, whether this is right at the end of 1976 or the beginning of 1977, but before, you know, maybe Jesse Dukes is alive, but the rest of us are not born.
I'm like 1 year older, you know, than both of you.
So someone on the server kills the Doomsday Machine.
Uh-huh.
They send chat, you know, everyone's like sends messages of congratulations. And then the Doomsday Machine respawns. Whoever coded the thing puts it back. And so somebody else has to send their machine in to blow it up. And people kind of figure out how to do it. And then the contemporary term for this in gaming culture would be that relatively quickly they get the Doomsday Machine on farm status, which means when these world bosses are released, nobody knows how to beat them. It's incredibly difficult. And then eventually, like, the noobiest noobs in the game, like, watch the YouTube video about how to do it. And they're able to relatively quickly do what the very first people took, you know, hours of practice and trying to be able to do. So, I mean, here's this really common phenomenon in 2020s gaming culture that we can trace back to these orange monitors in the 1970s. And the way to connect it back to education technology is that one of the things that I try to remind people all the time, Plato was, its programming language was called Tutor. It was designed first and foremost as a teaching system, although people immediately put games and ASCII pornography and all other kinds of things on top of it. Since we've had computers the size of your living room, computer scientists and learning scientists have partnered to figure out how we could use computers to improve the human condition through teaching and learning. It is not a newfangled thing. It is at this point like a 70-year enterprise for which we have tried almost anything you could imagine. The rate at which new ideas are generated is a trickle. Everything we build is just a riff on things that we've already tried before. And that is the right perspective. Like the best that we can do with education technology is not blossom brand new things like the primer. It's make these tiny tweaks on things that already exist. But if you build a tiny tweak, which is useful to 100,000 or a few million people for a little bit, then, you know, that meaningfully accrues into making the world a better place.
Okay. But before we let you go, earlier, you sort of explained why the AI's teaching abilities in this book are basically impossible in the scope of the world that Stevenson has laid out. That you could imagine an AI that could be as effective a teacher as the primer is, but you would need thousands and thousands of years of observation of actual teachers teaching in order to get that. So it's impossible. But let's say that you had the actual primer of this particular book available to you, and you had Miranda on hire with an infinite bank account, and you had your own children. Would you A, send them to your local public school district, or B, give them the primer? You can only choose one.
Oh, of course I send them to the local public school district because their teachers love them. And that
Miranda loves Nell.
Yeah, Miranda can't find Nell. Miranda has to go like live in a sex orgy gestalt culture to be able to find, which, you know, admirable and whatever. But I just assume, you know, let her go get hugged by Miss
underwater Kutzer. Burning Man, as we call it.
Yeah, the whole, I mean, like we're all a little burned out on Stevenson, but we're still going to get there. But boy, the second halves of his books are sometimes like, it's like watching a loom run in reverse.
Justin, tell us once again, you mentioned your book. If somebody's interested in your work, your lab's work, and sort of learning more, and they're intrigued by you intellectually, where can they go to learn more about you and your research?
Yeah, Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education, from Harvard University Press. And then I run a lab at MIT called the Teaching Systems Lab, which is tsl.mit.edu. Most people who go to that website go to look at the research that we did on pandemic schooling around COVID, tsl.mit.edu/COVID-19. And then we make a bunch of public media. So we have online courses at the MIT Open Learning Library. We have a podcast about the art and craft of teaching called the Teach Lab Podcast. And we have a documentary film that we just put out. We have to do something different. Teachers on the Journey to Become More Equitable Teachers at somethingdifferentfilm.com. And you probably didn't write all that down, but just hit your little replay button and you'll get it. Or Jesse and Chris will put in the show notes if they are doing show notes.
We are going to do show notes for purposes just like that. Thank you again for listening to our pilots and for giving us your feedback.
It's a dream come true. It's a total pleasure.
Yeah, this is amazing. If you had said in 1993 that the three of us would be sitting in a room recording a podcast, I'd be amazing.
Chris Bagg and I would be in a tea shop being like, who's Jesse Dukes? We've never heard of this guy before.
And what is a podcast?
And what is a podcast?
Who's Jesse Dukes and what is a podcast? That's exactly what we would say in the Grafton tea shop where Chris and I
But we
met.
Would love it. We would be like, that sounds great.
Like, that sounds amazing.
Sounds amazing. Let's head in that direction.
We're in other sides of the country talking to each other and about books that we like that were written in the 90s right now. This
right
is
now?
Hang on. We are going to have video phones and they basically are just your computer.
Upper Middlebrow is a Small Point production. Chris Bagg and Jesse Dukes producers. Music from Ben Pajak.
Pajak.
Music from Ben Pajak and Jesse Dukes. You can learn more about us at uppermiddlebrow.com. And thanks to the people who listened to the pilot and gave us feedback, including Justin Reich, Catherine Nagasawa, Adam Brock, Robert Lorzel, Jenny Grieve, and Josh Lieberlis.
Thank you, Justin, for coming on. We'll see you next time.
It's a great pleasure. Bye, guys.
Many thanks to Jesse and Chris for having me on Upper Middlebrow, which you can find on uppermiddlebrow.com and wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, thanks for listening to Teach Lab. We've got a couple of new episodes we're working on about teacher speech that we're excited to share with you. You can subscribe to Teach Lab Podcast at teachlabpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts to get all of the latest. You can learn more about our new documentary film, We Have to Do Something Different, at somethingdifferentfilm.com. The documentary showcases a terrific group of classroom educators exploring the best ways to serve all of their students. The special crossover episode was mostly produced by Jesse Dukes and Chris Bagg, but our dear colleague Garrett Beasley helped with the wrapper. Stay safe. Until next time.